afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome for another recording. Today, we are recording episode number 116 on the channel. I want to thank the audience for following us, sharing the comments with me. And if you have any ideas for future episodes that you or topics that you'd like to find a little bit more about, please send them to me via email. Today, I'm honored and I have the distinct pleasure to have with me Neil Tua. And Neil is the Chief Executive Officer for Voltage Holding. And Voltage Holdings is a company that does many things. We can't wait today to find out a little bit more about it from the man himself. And today we have two objectives. One is get to know Neil a little bit on his journey, where he started, where he is right now, and also to get to know, hopefully, a lesson for the audience and for those who are interested, the journey also from corporate to entrepreneurship. And how do we make this crossing, which to some people, it's a major challenge.
Yeah.
And for those who have done it, they say, we've done it, never looked back. I enjoyed the journey. For some people, it's scary still. So hopefully we demystify some of those elements today, especially the economies where I am in Canada and various other countries where our listeners are, tend to be a little bit on the soft side. So a lot of people, again, into that place where they're saying, should I stay in corporate or should I move to entrepreneurship? Neil, welcome to the conversation. I really appreciate your time today.
Hey, Robin. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you, sir. Glad to be
here. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us. Neil, if we can start, we say on this channel, everybody's got a story.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start with a soft one. Tell us your story.
Yeah. In simple terms, I won't bore everybody with the details or things only my mom would find interesting. But really, I've been an entrepreneur for the last 18 years, started a series of online and offline companies in the high-tech, mobile, consulting, physical product, and e-commerce spaces, and oil and gas. So I threw in a whole lot of different things in the last 18 years in different companies. What I ended up with about 12 years ago was a kind of finding my niche, pivoting through, you know, life and challenges and business, ups and downs, highs and lows, and landed in the physical product world of e-commerce and never looked back. So 12 years been in the brand building side of physical products, manufacturing, and private label brands. And predominantly has started on the Amazon FBA channel, the Fulfilled by Amazon channel. You guys know it, the thing that shows up at your house every 2 weeks when your wife orders, or every 2 days. Or in fact, we laugh and we joke, if my wife goes 45 minutes not ordering anything on Amazon, they call her and ask her if she's okay. There's a lot of you out there that are doing that. And so I appreciate that, because you might be buying some of my products that are selling on Amazon. But we also end up in places in the direct-to-consumer world, websites, Shopify, TikTok, retail, and other places as well, to expand those brands out with a specific capitalistic, big, hairy, ambitious goal. You know, want to know what it is? My big, evil capitalistic agenda, Robin?
Yes.
It is to build that business to an exit and sell it.
Absolutely.
And at that, yeah.
I saw that in one of your comments, built to an exit.
Built to an exit and acquisition. So we're actually on the other side of that now. I'm closing a rather large acquisition at the end of this week. It's about an $8 million acquisition on a company that does about $12 million a year, omni-channel opportunities. So just kind of the scope of what we do. We're not really playing business. We are in business. And that's something that I've really had a fun experience with learning how to do over the last 18 years.
So, you know, going through your profile online, Neil, you started with, I shouldn't say you started, but one of your jobs was a corporate job at IBM.
It was.
2003, 2007.
You did your homework.
How did you do the move, and what drove you to do the move to the entrepreneurial world?
Well, like everybody probably listening to this call, you're always looking for something you feel is the right thing to do, what I'm going to call a perceived guarantee that if I leave this job, I'm going to have this outcome. I can earn this amount of money. I'm going to have all these wonderful, you know, hopium things occur to me if I get into business for myself. And it's a tough racket, actually, on the other side to kind of get started if you don't know what to sell and who to sell it to. So for 2 years after my mentor died in kind of a tragic accident, I had that time period where I was working in a corporation, really just realizing that I should have taken his advice while he was still alive. And then around 2007, I'd reached a point where I was like, okay, I'm just done with this. I flew 200 days in a Road Warrior, in 2006. And I'm like, this is no way to build a family. I'd met a girl. I was going to get married in March of 2007. I'm like, I want my life to be very different. I want to be out of this. It actually was spawned off a call in the previous December of 2006. I was sitting around a table with a bunch of consultants doing the last dinner. We were about to leave the project. Everybody was, you know, doing this kind of stuff. And I was sitting next to a gentleman who I'd been working with for almost a year. And he was in his 50s at that point. I was in my late 20s, and he was on a phone call with his daughter and was missing her party and then missing her dance recital. And he was talking about how he, you know, wanted to get home, and that he hopefully his plane wasn't going to be delayed, and So as my mindset was shifting, I finally opened up my consciousness to listen to what he was saying. I finally took into what it was going on. I was like, I don't want to be that guy. You know, I'm 28 going on 29. I don't want to be doing this when I'm 50, 55 years old. I just don't see the value in now getting married and having a family, which was my goal, and then being this guy who's never around, right? So IBM said, well, hey, guess what? 2007, we're moving your division to Argentina, or you can take early retirement, or you can go find another place in the company. Good luck. And I'm like, well, crap, there's my moment, right? So In about February of that time frame, I knew that was going to happen. I understood it would happen around June or so. We got married in March, and then it did happen. And so I just said, you know, goodbye. I'm out the door. I burned the boats and never looked back. I didn't burn the bridges. Very important difference. I burned the boats. I just said, literally, I'm never going back to a corporate job after this. And I just made a resolution to myself and my family, I wouldn't do that.
So when the burning the boats, I love that. My background is in localization. So burning the boats, that came from when the Moors invaded Spain.
There you go. You know your history.
For our audience.
Yep.
And the famous saying that says, you know, the Moors built the king at the time, or the emperor, burned the boats and told his soldiers, the enemy is in front of you and the ocean is behind you. So
there's no going back. Yeah, it's actually funny because you're French by nature, if I remember correctly, by your culture.
Yes,
I am. I tracked my family through my father's lineage up through Quebec, Canada, that was part of the Hudson Bay Trading Fur Company, who came across from Normandy, France, where the Viking hordes landed and they basically had their back against the seawall. And that's where they sort of landed. That's where I kind of lost track of about Normandy, France, where my dad's descendants came from. So it's a great analogy because I understand where it's historical.
Absolutely. And you know what? This you remind me of the sixth degree of separation for everybody, right? So it's
that's right.
One of those things that we tend to think we're different, but we're not that different.
No, we're not that far off from each other. Not really. You know, locations, times, cultures, even languages can be different. But in a lot of, structure of family life, desire, goals, ambitions, both men and women, we share a lot of commonalities, right?
That's right.
And so, you know, I just decided that was the end of it. And no matter what I did, I wasn't going to go back. And I pivoted probably 20 times during that first decade before I ended up in the place that I'm at now, which is in the physical product world. So I just want everybody to understand, you know, there is no perfect path. There was no perfect time. I know you may have heard this. Maybe this is the first time you're hearing it. Maybe it's the moment that you needed to hear it and you weren't listening. But there is no perfect time to get out on your own and start something. There's work to be done. There's time, energy, attention, and money to be deployed. You can't do it for free. You're going to have to treat it like a real business, not a side hustle or a hobby. And that's what I understood when I left the business, was this was not a side hustle or a hobby. This would become my life. And I just simply said, there's no other option.
Yes, right. That's right. Now, why Amazon FBA? You must have had other options. So what drove you to that?
Yeah. Well, I was actually doing lead generation for mobile marketing before all the systems you see in place. We were actually uploading marketing campaigns in spreadsheets, and we were doing it across the mobile system. See, I was in Sprint when the mobile division launched, the PCS division that would eventually become one of the leaders in the industry before they sold. And we were on the first teams that launched the first mobile. I was on the first 5,000 people conglomerated through internet and internet sites that were brought across from telco and other places. I was a contractor. I got hired in and we started launching mobile phones. And I got to see that industry grow from the inside out and how fast it was moving. In 5 years, there were 80,000 employees. We had a 6-man team that moved to a 12-man team. We were supporting the first couple thousand reps. And by the time I left, there were 25,000 reps. So it was just an explosive growth inside of that company. And actually, I got picked up by IBM for the work I did at Sprint. They said, come to IBM and do this for us, right? But when I got up to the point of Amazon FBA, I was doing lead generation, mobile apps, affiliate marketing. And what I realized, as most people, I think, advance themselves forward down the beach because they can't go backwards, the end result was I needed to find a way to make that a real business, not just a business that traded some of my time for what was becoming very good money, but I didn't own the product. I didn't own the last mile to the customer. I owned the front end and the marketing, which I was very good at. But I just discovered I was really just trading more time for money in a nicer box. I didn't actually own the product. I didn't have the complete business together. And once that clicked, I'm like, okay, how do I complete this in component? Do I do it digitally or physically? Well, at that point, digital was a great opportunity and still is in many ways. AI is going to shift that a lot. Maybe we'll talk about that. But for me, logically, maybe because I'm Gen X and there was no internet when I was growing up and all this stuff, I was more connected to physical products than I was digital, even though I was playing digital. So I logically thought, make physical products and connect them to my digital marketing. And that's when I found a post of a friend of mine who was on Facebook one night up late trying to figure out what to do next. And he said, hey, I'm selling stuff on FBA. So I messaged him. I'm like, what the heck is FBA? And he's like, it's called Fulfilled by Amazon. They bought this company. It's a logistics freight company. They're calling it FBA. You can ship your products to them and they'll ship it to the customer. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So it just caught my attention that there was this company moving with an infrastructure. There was an opportunity. There was an upside and I could do the marketing and the branding and the business side. I didn't know how to do the physical product side. So I went and figured it out.
When you say product, can you give us an idea?
Yeah.
You're doing business to consumer, I'm assuming, right?
Business to consumer. Yeah. I mean, we sell all kinds of things. Probably easier to tell you what I don't sell. Okay. I don't have a supplement company. I don't have a jewelry and clothing and accessory company. And I don't have an electronics company. Now, I have electric products in here. Like I have an ice cream maker machine called a Bleezy that we just launched, which puts basically self-serve on the countertop in your house in 20 minutes, 25 minutes. Literally, you don't have to freeze it or make it. You pour all the ingredients in and 25 minutes later, you're siphoning out ice cream, organic coconut, regular ice cream, dairy-free protein. You can do it all in this machine. It's super cool. We sell bed sheets, high-end bed sheets, bamboo and other types of sheets. We sell, oh shoot, man, there's a whole list. We're going to be selling air fryer soon to compete with Ninja. So we sell literal physical products, right? Like in your house, in your usage. I've got a coffee company called Ambrista that sells a very high-end espresso machine and sells a 12-cup. And we're going to be launching the burr grinder. And we're building out the portfolio of those products now. I could keep going. I don't want to bore you all. But we have like all these brands and niches and types. But they have to meet a certain requirement. Like it answers the question, what the heck do I sell? Which is usually the first question most people have. What do I sell to become successful? Now, I flipped like 5 or 10 products when I first got going because I had no idea what I was doing. And we were just flipping products for profit. But being a business person, I realized I need to control the trademark. I need to control IP. I need to control it. So then we got into private manufacturing where those products were created for us. So instead of just flipping other people's products, we were marketing and selling products that were ours within our IP. And that really changed the game. So between 2013 and 2015, we built a 7-figure company. I hit the first 7 figures in sales in 2015. And once you cross that threshold, not just in business, you know, the first million in revenue, but once you cross that learning curve of struggling to battle your way to that first million, it's an uphill climb. It's a struggle. It's time. It's money. It's heartache. It's sweat. I mean, I went bankrupt in another business because I was trying to be Elon Musk. I was trying to invent products. I got patents and I went really far down the process and I forgot the most critical thing. Sales fixes everything. So instead of selling the product,
I know, illnesses, Neil.
Yeah, instead of selling it enough, I over-engineered it. It's a super awesome product that no one's ever going to hear. It's got a patent that they can't touch and no one's ever going to get it. So I learned the innovation methodology of product evolution and innovation of variations and differentiation of variations. And that's when things became more fun and faster. And after the first million, it was a lot easier to start identifying through a process we developed called green light, which whether or not it goes green, yellow or red, depends upon which product you sell. And then we started to set minimum thresholds of the profitability of the product to the brand, to the business, and what we would not launch that did not maintain that profitability. And that, again, started to really change things because we elevated the profit of the business. And by doing that, we could not only just pay ourselves more, we could market more, and we could develop more brands, and they would grow exponentially faster.
Absolutely. So this is quite the change, though, Neil. I mean, you started doing the marketing piece. And now I hear you talking almost like an industrial integration throughout the entire process.
Yeah, we're an aggregator of product because I own 12 brands. We control another 12 directly that we developed with our partners. And we're acquiring companies, as I mentioned earlier, that are developing this out. So, you know, it's just that amount of pivoting and adapting. And this room is filled with failures and product samples, which are sitting over here, to kind of identify where the combination of skill set would lie. And I actually met a guy in that time frame, in that 2012, 2013 time frame, named Reed. And he was a serial entrepreneur, had holdings in real estate and storage and all kinds of stuff, had all this experience. And now he's kind of like, well, what do I want to be when I grow up? And he realized he wanted to be in e-commerce. We spent about an hour on the phone and realized, you know, I held this part of the knowledge and he held that part of the knowledge. And his was more of the development, manufacturing, and back end side, COO, CFO style man. I'm on the other side, you know, jump off the bridge, let's go for it, you know, build the parachute on the way down, big picture thinking, I can see strategy at the top end. And that's the opposite of him. So we ended up kind of making one brain. And with that, we sort of developed our rhythm as to what to do with the business in terms of how we moved a product, how we identified the product, and then using Amazon as an incubator, literally, how do we test market that brand? Now, here's the thing. It was about 20% of the e-commerce market share or less in 2012. It's now 49% of the market share for United States e-commerce park. So it has jumped enormously in the growth, and it's a great place for us to test market these products, find out if there's mass market adoption, and then move them into the other channels of sales once they become successful. And for us, successful means a six, multi, seven figure, even eight figure company before we'll move it into other channels.
So you have a complete, my understanding from what you just said, Neil, that you have a complete infrastructure, meaning that you have the employees, you do warehousing. I'm assuming there's FBA, of course, but you must do some return. You must handle some other side of the transaction, not just selling the product. I'm assuming you handle the support.
Well, yes and no, right?
No, okay.
Okay, so let me explain what happens. So Amazon's warehouses are extremely robust. They have the FBA warehouses, and then they added on during COVID what they call AWD, Amazon Warehouse Distribution, which basically was a hyper growth situation. And they just started buying every warehouse they could get their hands on that was close to their FBA distribution centers and literally connected them together for extra storage. So they have most all the storage we need. We do have a third-party logistics company that can help us combine and pack and do intermediary of products. And in the company we're buying, there's a 10,000 square foot warehouse in California, but it's the only one we have. Also, I don't have any employees. So here's what I did that was probably a little different than most of you are thinking, because I got out of the employee mindset and said I never wanted to go back there. I tried employees, 12 of them, for about a year and a half, and then fired them all. So in the process of that, I identified a better way. It takes a little bit longer, but in my process, I started to train the CEO operators in business. So folks like yourself and others who had the intention, the desire, and the capital, I started training them one-on-one to become a CEO of an e-commerce company, to replicate our system, technology. Mm-hmm. We have an internal development team. We have an internal software we use called the Greenlight dashboard, powered by what we call Cayman Intelligence Engine we developed, which is AI and artificial intelligence and other things running around inside of it, including 12 years of data that it uses to help us identify our product pipeline and then helps us with the product launch of that. It's a product development platform. So we developed that internally, and then I taught others how to do it. So actually I have a group of people who were raised up and became CEO operators. Now the group of the CEO operators, I asked who wants to raise up a company with me or acquire a company or be an operator for a company I own. And I had five people raise their hands, and they were sort of the cream of the crop. They were the top, and ended up partnering with them into the businesses we run now. And so I have those operators running our companies. They're CEO operators who have success in their own venture, who now run their own companies and then help me run and develop and grow these other companies. So I have no employees. What I have is a highly skilled workforce who's been very successful that gets paid out of the profit.
That's right. So there's a name for that. There's employee that have stock in the company, I'm assuming.
They get an ownership percentage into the agreement, usually 10%, that is given to them as the operator. And we have ourselves and capital partner in there for the funding and the growth of the business. And they get to run that with us.
Is this something recent you did, Neil, or this has been around for a while?
No, it's about a year old. We have a number of clients we worked with internally before I opened kind of that more partnership related side to people inside of my business. Mm-hmm. It isn't something I open outside the company. It is only something that with people who have built businesses with us as part of our business builder group, and then can, you know, if interested, can apply to be a partner with us and come into that partner relationship.
Of course.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about business growth and some strategy that you've implemented or you've applied. Talk a little bit about what are the key principles that you would think are behind or a contributing factor to, let's say, a highly automated, scalable FBA business, even to the point of, you know, generating passive income. As you mentioned earlier, you've got software, you've got automation done, you're using some AI. You know, let's talk a little bit about all those principles, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I call it the almost automated income, because there's still components that require me to be involved. But at this point, I no longer touch the images, graphics, files, and the components of operations, because I have operators. So now we're at the business decision justification and business management level and capital deployment and fiscal responsibilities, which is a slightly more passive version, if you will, than the operators who run it. But really the core fundamentals are understanding the profitability first. Every business has a profit and loss statement. We need to maintain profitability. Therefore, we only launch products that meet certain criteria. For example, the machines and businesses I just mentioned to you, along with the others, we don't sell products that are less than $50 in retail price point. I typically sell products between $100 to $500 in retail price point. They are high use cases, meaning there is a competitor of high demand already in there, maybe entrenched for a little while, who doesn't have a very good competitor. And in our data, we analyze and determine that the profitability is there first, and then the high demand competition is there. And then we project forward how much time, energy, attention, and money it will take to take up market share in this division, in this first sales channel, Amazon. So with that, it's a numbers game. So many people think about the products. That's actually my second consideration. I know it sounds weird to everybody and a little bit backwards because I was a product inventor, right? But what I discovered in terms of timelines of sales and opportunity, 99% of people are innovators, not inventors. 99% of the products in the marketplace are innovations, not inventions. And that you can make millions of dollars doing that, and you don't have to have this huge one-hit wonder, and you don't need to go on Shark Tank, and you don't have to have this unique genius idea that no one's ever heard of, because there's so much more that has to be sold. So the principles by which we fundamentally build these companies are by the data and numbers first, because at its foremost, you need to understand online now, you are selling data to AI engines, okay? And part of my principle of understanding that was back in IBM, I was working on a number of projects across knowledge management and language and machine learning and artificial intelligence and part of the Watson Superblue computer we booked time on at RMonk in order to run our calculations and do our criteria. And that was the foundation by which we were building large language models of today. Now that was 25 years ago. So this has gone significantly more advanced, but that fundamental understanding of that entire ecosystem is what I use to base my understanding of Amazon's algorithms in the early 2012 to 2014 timeframe, and the changes they've made in the last 3 to 4 years with AI intelligence systems. One now is called Cosmo, which is an AI-driven customer need and customer intent. So it's all data selling to an algorithmic engine. Sure. Image, copy, graphic, listing, the launch process is all geared to get the AI system to properly understand the value statement of my product over the other data sets that are setting in Amazon. Then I make sure, once I know that's possible, that I deliver a better than product. I deliver a great product, a product that someone will use. It won't break in 5 minutes. They'll like it. They'll leave a positive review and close that entire cycle successfully, repeatedly. If I do one or the other really good, it kind of fails, right? If I sell a whole lot, but the product crashes out, I got a problem. If I spend too much time engineering a really super great product and I don't sell it well, the business crashes out. So the balance is between those two metrics. And most folks tend to invert them, right? So I prefer to test the sales mechanism first for high profitability, high demand. And if I run into a product problem, a defect, a manufacturing issue, something we didn't see that in a number of units creates an issue, then we fix the product because I know I can sell it, right? That's my opportunity, fix the product. So that is one of the biggest fundamentals of this type of business a lot of people miss. They'll think I need a super high product and then I'm going to go buy 5,000 units. That's a mistake. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a product base and I'm going to take 200 to 300 units of it. And I'm going to do a market test because I'm not smart enough to tell the market what it wants, but I am smart enough now to read the data. And since it's all data driven, I'm looking for certain things of this algorithm and online algorithms to respond positively to my product to tell me I'm over the target. This is in demand. This is sales. The audience intersect of my product data and this algorithmic engine are saying it's matched up. Right? And the value of it is greater than the value of the existing data inside the system. I know I'm sort of technical here, so forgive me for that. But in simple terms, my data has to be better in the eyes of the algorithm so I can sell more. Then when I fulfill more product, the two combine together for hypergrowth. What can happen? Well, I have a couple of client case studies to prove some of the largest ones on Amazon. One got to $5 million a month in 8 months, and the other one just closed a $29 million deal on his company after 5 years in business. And so that's a pretty good scalability for the virility inside of these engines that can propagate so much traffic, so much information, so fast. I think most people don't even comprehend at the speed at which it's moving. Right? Amazon moves 6,000 units a minute through their system, right? Peak 9 to 10,000 units per minute during prime days and holidays. There is a juggernaut of people who want products in the United States, and there's really no reason why anybody can't sell it if they follow the right criteria and they follow the right steps to validating the market.
Absolutely. And you bring a very valid point, which every industry is going through this right now, is that laser focused on understanding the data.
Yes.
And try to understand the algorithm that is going to, and nowadays try to understand how the AI models are going to comprehend the data and make decisions on that data.
Yes.
You mentioned a couple of times the algorithm and the connection between the algorithm and understanding the data. Is this a static algorithm, or the algorithm changes and then you have to change your data sets and adjust it, I guess, for the new algorithm? And how do you stay on top of that?
Yeah, so we have been investigating it for years. We've written it into the development. We've written it into the agents that help us analyze the data that I'm getting from Amazon. So I have Amazon's data in what's called Product Opportunity Explorer. My agents get the different data requirements we're looking for, and then our analytic Kamen engine goes in and massages that data to get the output for the specific business metrics I want. And most importantly, the ones that align most closely with that Cosmo engine I mentioned earlier, which is a customer need, customer intent engine ran by AI. So it is an adaptive engine that is learning and growing based on all the users that are feeding it information. Now, there's such a thing in quantum, and I'm not going to get into this very long because I know about this much, and I'll sound really stupid if I go too far. But I know enough to be dangerous. And what I know is there is an error rate in quantum computing that has to be lowered over time through the amount of calculations it does. So it needs more and more and more data to lower the calculations before an accuracy point. And if I understood it correctly in layman's terms, there's a point in the line where AGI occurs when the error rate reaches a point where the literal agent, the information, can become sentient in its learning, right? And so with these engines piling on all this information and moving mass adoption, what they're doing by everybody making images, videos, using AI, playing with these GPTs is we're training it. We're training it to become smarter. Amazon's training theirs to become smarter. All the algos are training them to become smarter, which is both an awesome opportunity and very scary at the same time, if you've ever seen Terminator. Because like August 29th, 2025 had just passed, was when it became sentient, and then all hell broke loose. When Skynet went live. But as we keep to train this, it is a dynamic growing. However, there are fundamentals of its data it's looking for to, in essence, meet audience information. And since I'm selling information whose connectivity to that information is a physical product that is delivered, it's no different than someone who's just selling information to the AI. And in that way, it is dynamic. But once it's dialed into the audience, once it knows the customer need and intent that is already driving this demand for that product, somebody who wants ice cream machines a million times a year, it knows who they are, what they were going to buy, what they might buy now and buy in 3 years. It already knows what their favorite color is, where they live, how many social media posts they've made, you know, who their uncle, cousin's brother, second, third person is. And it has all that scary information about all of our profiles. And it is becoming more and more intelligent as an advertising machine, to the point where if you've seen Minority Report with what's his face, where he's like walking around and it's all, yeah, we're headed there. I don't know how to say it any differently. It's the best way to kind of people to get their mind around where this is going. You know, super smart, intelligent machines and marketing engines that are putting that product right in front of you. So the product itself and the desire and demand is a stagnant river, okay, flowing through, you know, Amazon's river, but it's also a data filing cabinet of information that is adapting and changing based on what's in demand, based on what is being innovated in that demand. And once you fit into that data, hold on, because these systems can go fast with you. They can go extremely fast.
And you know what? You bring a very good point, because we're all connected to many devices. You know, you have Google Home at home, you've got Alexa, you've got your phones, you've got your tablets and computers.
We're feeding millions of data points a second into these engines.
I'm assuming all the data points are fused together to form that intent from all these devices.
100%. So they can go into Amazon, and what it's doing now is it's basically making logical conclusions. For example, if I go in and I say, I'm looking for a dog carrier, well, the logical outcome it already understands is if I want to carry a dog, there's a good chance I'm going to the park, I'm taking it to a vet, I'm doing other cases. It already makes the known. So it has an intent. So what would it do with that intent? If you buy that product, it knows you're most likely going to use one of 59 different things that that carrier can do. And then it's going to start presenting you with all the product outcomes that match that intent.
That's right.
Right? So you're like, well, I got the carrier to carry my dog around because I didn't want it walking on the ground when I take it to the vet. So then it's going to start showing you vet medicine and pet supplements, because it knows that most likely you're doing that, or it's going to show you other intent. And then as you signal that intent, it will start dialing in which particular reason why you bought that product. And it will simply show you more of those customer needs and customer intent products. It's a very crazy system, actually.
Absolutely.
All of it.
Yeah. And for the individual user out there who are not necessarily from the generation of saying connected is okay, they may consider it like freaky almost to some extent.
Well, and you know, I do too to some degree, but I'm also fascinated by its possibilities. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a business that when done correctly, it can transform your life. I mean, it is a business that creates opportunity, sustainability, 24/7, 365. I'm making sales when I'm asleep, when I'm on vacation, right? I'm building an asset, right? I'm building a business that is a saleable asset in the end. More than likely, it's worth more in the end than at any time when I was building it. And it becomes predictable in its growth cycle because it's just a series of data and data tracking and data identification, so much so that we built tools and algorithms to show us exactly the customer needs and intents and cross them over with the most profitable outcome so I can remove the stress, the volatility, the sales issues, and simply go to market with those products and validate, is my data better than theirs? Out of that, I've created financial freedom. I've got a lot more time with my family. I've got confidence in the model and repetition of the model. And those are all very wonderful things to have in business.
Absolutely. And you know what? You keep bringing a very important topic that I keep talking about here and on the channel is the successful entrepreneur will start by understanding the data. Once you've got a complete understanding of the data and you stayed on top of the data, that becomes your key success factor. It doesn't matter what business you're in. Be it a manufacturer, be it an entrepreneur such as yourself, or anything really. If we get to understand the data right to the nth degree, I think we got a better chance at delivering the right product to the right market, to the right services to the right market.
That's right. That's exactly what it comes down to. Yeah. And I just happened to learn that that was the opportunity that I pivoted into that logically made sense at that next step to own the entire business through beginning to end. And there where I got out of the entrepreneurial mindset, out of the, you know, component of what I thought was business building when in actuality, I was just working on somebody else's company. And instead I was now a true business owner.
Sure. Neil, let's move a little bit about some lesson learned. You mentioned earlier about some stuff that didn't really go as well as you expected to go.
Yep.
Would you mind sharing candidly, you know, what was your worst investment or decision that triggered perhaps a red flag for you?
Yep.
And what was the experience?
So it's going to borderline the concept of what's called the sunk cost fallacy. Are you familiar with that? Right? The aspect of when do I quit or give up on something when I put so much time in? How far do I go? When do I give up? Well, I am somebody who doesn't know where that boundary is still. And so in my life, I've had, you know, great successes and terrible failures because of that. And what I've learned to do, and maybe I'll share that in a minute. So the end part is that I had a business opportunity. I invested capital into it. I had some friends and family that invested into it. We were in the development of a product with a patent. It was kind of revolutionary at that time for energy conservation and energy management at the home or business. It was being brought out to major companies. We had large investors. It turns out that, you know, while we weren't selling the product, the other partners were sort of taking funds they shouldn't be taking, violating some SEC rules. I didn't know about that, but I discovered that one day when I hadn't been paid in 6 months and I was running out of money and I deployed my capital and I'd gone too far into the business to basically pull out of it financially, only to discover there wasn't really any money because it had been taken. So out of that, I had to declare a business bankruptcy and decide whether or not which version I would go. And I went down the path of declaring a Chapter 11 restructuring because I wanted to pay off the debts. I wanted to honor what I had done wrong. And so in that process, I had to get indemnified from the company. That was not fun. I had a pregnant wife and she had to go through that process with me. And we had to go down in the dank basement at the Tulsa courthouse with 20 other poor souls who were crying as they went in front of these bankruptcy judges and had to own all of that consequence and issue. Had to own that, you know, with my family and with the money that was taken, the money I'd put in, the money that some of our friends and family put into the business. And I had to own all that. And it was not a very fun time for me at all. And Roden basically ran out most of my capital doing it to pay the lawyers and get out. And at one point, at the very bottom of it all, I took a screenshot of my Arvis bank account where I had $567 in total to my name. And I had a wife and kids and we were in the house. Now, God shows up in those places. So that's my first principle of fundamental is faith. If you don't have faith, you shouldn't probably be in business. I'm just going to say that point blank from my own perspective. Okay. And it was faith that allowed me to walk that process and come back from that. And in that process, there were certain things that occurred. In that, and under those failures, I was lifted up into a new relationship with Jesus Christ until I gave up the entire business to him. And I said, I'm done. I did it my own way. I failed. It was terrible. And I can't do it myself. So I'm giving it to you and I'll just step back and you tell me where to go. And I know that sounds kind of weird, like, you know, the whole joking, Jesus, take the wheel, right kind of thing. But it was really just like, I can't do this. I don't know what to do. I'm so gone. I'm lost. I need to feed my kids. I can't pay for the car. You know, what is happening here? This is falling apart. And so I actually felt really good after that. And what ended up happening is we went to the final step in the basement of this dank place. It's like Joe versus the volcano, where you go down in the basement and the lights are cracking and it's just this nasty gray thing. And I'm like, where are we? We're not in a courtroom. It's so weird, dude. And we go down there, and again, 20 poor souls are down there, and we walk into this room, and it's just a giant conference area where they set up partitions. There were 20 of those white folded tables, and apparently each person was a judge, and each person was being filtered in waves to sit in front of these judges, and I'd never seen anything like it in my life. Like, I thought, you know, naively, I was going to in front of a judge in front of the guy, and we were going to sit in a courtroom, and this was going to be, no. Now, they reserve that for, like, the really bad stuff. For you and the poor suckers and the bankrupts, you get thrown in the basement. So we go in there, we do this thing, Hannah's life, we'd made some payments, we made a plan, I was going to honor it no matter what I did, I was going to repay this. And the judge takes a look at us, he takes a look at the plan, he sees we made good on some of it, he looks at my pregnant wife, and God's moment just went over him, and he's just like, I'm going to write your debt off. And I said, excuse me, you're going to do what? He goes, no, I can write your debt off, I'm going to just give you a clean slate, it's like you need it, you're going to start over, you're not going to have any credit score or money, but you're not going to have any more debt. And I'm like, you can do that? So we were absolutely dumbfounded. So with that, we went out of there, and it was a low point. We had to pay with cash for everything. We had to go on food stamps for a little bit. We had to take a few social services, but as quickly as we got on them, I got us off of them as quickly as I could. And knew, you know, leverage that for the little walk we went on, which was no fun whatsoever. And just had to humble ourselves. They came and took the car, right? At like 10 o'clock at night, forgot to close the garage door, which didn't matter anyways, because they repoed our van right out of the garage. You know, pregnant wife crying, so much trouble. I laugh about it now. It wasn't funny then. But, you know, but we got past that, and she's technically my ride or die, 18 years married now. We've come on the other side of that problem. But yeah, that was a super low point. You know, I've had my back against the wall, and I've had to figure it out. I understand what it means to risk everything financially. And I will tell you, Robin, there's nothing worse than not having failed and never tried. I will always be able to stand here and say that I failed bigger than most of you have tried. And the reason that I can still stand here is because I have a confidence and a faith that no matter what, I'm going to be okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the individual that starts by saying, jump off the bridge and figure out how to make the parachute on your way down. I'm not worried about that individual because, you know, we say yes and figure it out. I guess that's the
figure it out. Pivot. Don't get caught up in your ego. If you get caught up in your pride, be careful. Vanity is a slippery slope. It caught me. And, you know, I've been able to pull out of it. I've got better boundaries now. I've got stronger coping mechanisms. I've got more learning and experience and some far, you know, hard knocked wisdom that came out of that experience. And I don't regret having ever tried as hard as I did.
Nick, after what you just told me, I'm assuming your home life has supported better. Having gone through the process of agony, agonizing,
yeah,
bankruptcy, supported your entrepreneurial journey and come out on the other side much better, right? So I'm assuming there's a lot more support in that journey for you.
In my direct household and my wife, absolutely, 100%. Not all of my family and friends got it, and some of them left in the process, mm-hmm. right? Some of them were people we no longer talk to. Some of them wrote us off as risk and didn't want anything to do with us. Others just thought we were being stupid because we wouldn't give up and go back and get a job. My wife is an RN and BSN by trade. She was on her way to become a nurse practitioner. She's highly educated, but she decided during that time frame, and I respectfully agreed that it was the best maneuver, even though it did not make sense to anybody outside of our immediate family, that she should stay home and raise the children. That was the number one priority. And we agreed, and she has stuck to her guns and has become just like, you know, an amazing, you know, 15 years later, she's an amazing homeschooling mom who was the CEO of the house and has just basically said during that time frame previously, we're going to be okay. You will figure it out. I trust you. I trust God. And she has never been someone who ever said, go get a job, quit your dreams, quit this idea, knock it off, be serious. We don't have the money, blah, 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 blah. She just literally said, I got this, so you can go do that. And I will tell you, Robin, that's probably one of the greatest successes I've ever had. And it's one of the number two things I tell my daughters beyond the number one, which is control the controllables. Only control the things you can control and let go of the rest. Okay. Absolutely. Do not worry. Yep. Or fret about the things you cannot control for tomorrow. Okay. The second one is, it is the most important thing you will ever do in your life to choose properly who you marry. Right. And that has been, you know, and having been a failed marriage, okay, wrote on my roadmap, having a failed 6-year marriage that ended in divorce, I can tell you again that choosing the right partner in life can make all the difference in your business. Mm-hmm. And it's, and now as I've reached certain levels of business and community and connectivity through relationships and stuff, I will tell you the most successful friends I have are the longest married couples. Mm-hmm. And I mean success at very big levels, billionaires. And their success in moderation and their humility and who they are and the way they live their lifestyle is represented by the exact relationship they have with their spouse. And it's extremely powerful. And with that, I have been able to do what is ever necessary to provide for my family in whatever way I saw fit in the business of life, because my wife just didn't become an adversary to me at any point.
And you know what? These are the, you combine two things, the faith that you talked about earlier, family and family support and tenacity and making decisions going forward. I mean, those are key characteristics of an entrepreneur. Absolutely. And fun fact, while I was doing for our audience, apparently Neil lives on a 40 acres in the Ozark.
Unless, I do.
Unless it's changed. I don't know.
It's actually 55 now.
You've added a few.
Oh, yeah. We added some family plots. My parents are out here now, and my in-law has purchased some acreage here just recently to add to the community we have up here on the hill.
By the way, where are the Ozarks for our audience? I'm not familiar.
Yeah. Well, if you go out to Springfield, Missouri, okay, and you head out to Southwest, you'll end up near Branson. We're about an hour from there. It's a kind of a long range, goes all the way from Arkansas over to Alabama. We're on the more easterly side, Southwest eastern of the Ozarks. From here, it's jokingly the, like the moonshine of old, and they ran the old moonshines and stuff out the east on the other side. They did other nonsense in the Ozarks, but it's a wonderful place to be. It's an amazing climate. We can grow all kinds of things. We have a 50-foot by 100-foot heritage sea garden that we grow all kinds of amazing food and organic food. Winters are a little tough, not going to lie. I grew up on the West Coast, actually in Oregon, and I thought winters were tough when we went to the mountains at 7,000 feet, but we could come out of that and go down to the lower, 500,000 foot climates, and it was very different. Well, we live at 1,700 feet up here, and the winters get pretty brutal where we are. Oh, we get a lot of snow. Average is around 15, 20 inches. On the harder winters, it'll be 20 to 40 inches. Ice is a big problem up here. A lot of times more than snow, we get ice. But, because we live here, we work here, we homeschool our daughters, we live in a small community that's less than 1,800 people within the area 5 miles from us. There's an Amish community and a Mennonite community. There's a lot of homesteaders that have migrated into this area. We have a 65-kid school co-op that my wife helped co-found a while back. And she's now one of, she's like, to joke, she's one of the old school moms. She's like, how did I become one of the old homeschool moms? Because her and her friend have been a part of that for a long time. And so we have that community around us as well. And it's just been a way to develop a lifestyle by design that, quite honestly, Robin, if I'd looked back at that guy in 2007, this is where you're going to end up. Here's where you're going to live. Here's how your life is going to look. I'd say no way. No way, dude. That's
not
insane.
In the car.
Are you kidding me? Well, I lived it. I lived in cities. I lived on a cul-de-sac when I was a kid. I lived in Kansas City. I lived in New York and in Manhattan off Fulton Street for a while down there for almost a year. I've lived in big cities in concrete jungles. So when my wife, who is from Oklahoma, who grew up near to, 50, 200, 600 acre farms in her family, was like, I want to get 20 acres at some point. And we got married and I'm like, wow, I don't know what to do with 20 acres. What the heck am I going to do with 20 acres? That's insane. So 50 is not enough, just so you're clear. I probably want like another 100, because when you get going and the trucks get going or you're on the ATVs and you get out into the property, you run out of dirt. Like I ran out of dirt. Like I need more dirt. I'm running out of space. I need like 1,000 acres. I want to keep going.
You got to wait for your neighbors to start selling.
I am trying to get them to agree to sell me some of the land. There's a 200 acre cattle ranch is just over a beautiful butte on the hill right opposite of mine. Wonderful family. And I said, hey, look, I want option on that top 10 acres. Whenever you guys decide to sell, please let me know.
Totally. Neil, what is going forward? What is your most important goal?
My most important goal?
18 months.
Well, it's not, it is. Okay. I just totally trained wrecked in my brain there. Do you want it on the business side or the personal side? Or do you want to combine that? Or
whatever is important to you. I'm sure you have like a checklist. You got business and reciprocal personal goals, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I mean, my personal goals at this point are to raise my daughters up into a place where they understand the opportunity in business, but don't have to be the business person. But as they choose that second controllable.
Are they old enough to be part of the business now?
Or? Yeah, my 17-year-old is involved in the marketing and AI. My 15-year-old helped us unlock an entire data set from our data we didn't expect to understand, but her questioning and due diligence in that helped us unlock a whole new way of thinking of the data the developers went and figured out. So there are different levels. My 13-year-old runs a little eBay business that sells maybe 1 to 2 products a week that she goes out and reflips her money, runs her numbers, and then comes back and we sell the products and help her ship it and stuff. So, and the 12-year-old is still figuring out what's going on in life, and that's cool. We'll let her figure out where she wants to go next. But really, it's to get them to a place where they understand business enough, the numbers, the money, the opportunity, that even if they don't become the business person, but they're supporting someone who is, they can be my wife. They can be an exact replica of the way my wife has treated me through the business, the numbers, the finance, the way we lived our life, that they could be that together in their relationship, because I know that's going to be one of the greatest successes they'll ever have. By choosing that person, they can help and support and get in the dirt and get in the weeds and be a part of it if they need to, or be a part of the household. So that's one of my personal accomplishments, is to see them all come to that understanding, not necessarily work in my business, just get in a place where they really understand the value of that. Position and how powerful that actually is. It's not a submissive position like some people might be thinking. It's an extremely powerful position.
Absolutely.
That my wife has within our relationship. And I take it, don't take it lightly at all. We spend at least 4 miles a day talking over life and business. We walk about 4 miles every day together, and we have those conversations in depth. The business side is a little easier. We are acquiring companies through our private equity company we funded called Patriot Growth Capital. We're part of the founding group. They are capital raising and institutional through supporting veterans, 16,000 veterans last year through all different walks of life. Opening the e-commerce with my company has allowed them to create new lines of business and opportunities through acquisitions to hire veterans into the company at all different levels. So as we do these acquisitions, we're employing veterans into these. Our first acquisition should be completed this Friday. We kissed about 500 companies to get there, just so you understand the scope of that, right?
Oh, wow.
And so now we're targeting a bit larger, 10, 20, $50 million companies now for the next acquisitions as we tend to build that out.
All in the same type of?
All in the e-commerce world. Yeah, only one right now that we're looking at is a purely manufacturing play. It's a company in Wisconsin that does only manufacturing. We just see that as an opportunity for divestment. We both have manufacturing background, so it's not complicated for us. And we develop and manufacture products all the time. But it's a hedge against things that are changing, because you know there are trillions of dollars being committed to America. Our manufacturing is going to go and is already churning up in many, many, many ways. And we know by the next 2 years, it's going to be a very different scene for manufacturing in America. And we see that as an opportunity. So my 5-year goal is to have those 5 businesses under our belt, to have those business operating somewhere in between 50 and 100 million in sales a year. On top of our existing brands and growing them up into an acquisition position, my private equity partner groups are waiting for us to raise those companies up right now that we're building, so we can exit them.
Is it a 5-year cycle for you, Neil?
It's about a 5-year cycle. Yeah. So really, I plan to retire in the next 5 years as I roll up all of these brands that we're running right now.
Good for you. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Congratulations.
That's my goal. That's my big, hairy, audacious goal. We'll see what happens. Maybe it'll take me to 57. I don't know. I wanted to be a millionaire by
You know, like, you are a podcaster too. Like, somebody told me that you like to do podcasting.
I have had fun with that.
Can you talk us a little bit about this one? I know we still have a few minutes here.
Yeah, we started in 19. Well, let's see. I was going to say 2019, but that's different. We started in 2021 with the podcasting. I was just told to shove a mic in my face, get on camera, and interview people. So I did. It wasn't the best for 6 months. Let's put it like that. I wouldn't go listen to the first episodes of my podcast. They suck. But it got better, and I got kind of figure out a conversational rhythm. It's called the High Voltage Business Builders Podcast. It's interviewing folks like yourself, high voltage business builders and levels of aptitude and growth, typically 1 to 5 million in sales experience or higher, on the investment, on the business, on e-commerce, on the financial side. Even, Wealth Without Wall Street, investing in all kinds of strategies and bringing those to the table for people who've been successful. So I usually am interviewing the person in charge, the CEO, the owner, who's talking their story and talking about those different areas. And we've had some really great episodes. We've actually hit the top 3% of listen notes now. It's about 3.6 million podcasts. We're in the top 3% now.
Great. And you got a lot of followers?
I think I do. I don't keep track. That's a vanity metric. I don't really know. I don't do it for the monetary benefit of the podcast.
No, I understand that.
Because I don't charge anybody.
I don't do it for monetary reasons.
No, I've done it for brand and building and relationship. I've had a lot of relationships, so strategic, tactical relationships come off the podcast, been introduced to a lot of people. That's been a wonderful component of the business. even though I don't directly profit off the podcast.
And do you like to be guest on other podcasts, my understanding?
I do. I enjoy having this conversation because at the end, again, I don't have any employees. So when people get involved and work for us, you know, work with us for 12 months, become a CEO entrepreneur, learn the business building, and use my people, process, and technology to do it and follow a replicatable roadmap that we do daily, weekly, and monthly inside of our operations team, I raise them up to be operators. And then when they're successful, we partner. So I have that 3 to 5 year goal. And of course, I have the opportunity to acquire their business. So we have a first right of refusal inside the company, non-committal, other than a gentleman's agreement, that when their company reaches a certain point, we get an opportunity to acquire it from them before it hits the market. And so as we look to do that, I raise people up into success. And then my goal is to get them into a position of exit.
That's the mentoring side of you, right?
It is. Yeah, it's the coaching and mentoring. I love that aspect. I love to see people break beyond their barriers and succeed, become great operators. The four guys that are running our companies are just tremendous men. They're just amazing fathers and husbands. And they're just, they don't need me to micromanage them. They don't need me to meet with them every week. They know what to do. They know how to kick butt, and they just get in there and do it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you came on the Localization Fireside Chat podcast as a guest. I really appreciate your time with me. You know, I love the one of the quotes I got for you here. Feel the fear, do it anyway, but be smart about it. This is if there's any captioning for this episode with you, Neil, on this channel, would be this one, because that means a lot to many people, to me personally, and to many people. It is normal to feel apprehensive about things, but do it anyway. But just think about what you're doing and do it, thoughtfully.
It's what I say is choose your hard, right? It's hard to be poor, been there. Yep. It's hard to be wrong. It's hard to fail. It's hard to do the work. It's hard to be in business, but you get to choose your hard at the end of the day. And I prefer that some people choose the ones that create more opportunity than the ones that are just Mr. Right Now.
And any parting words?
I always remind people at the end of my podcast that their opportunity begins at the end of their excuses. And to do something imperfectly, and something perfect will happen along the way.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for being part of this conversation today, Neil. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Pleasure meeting you. And thanks for whoever arranged this. I want to thank them. That was a great conversation. I really enjoyed the conversation with you.
Thank you, sir. It's been an honor.
And I hope the audience feel the same. I'm sure they do. For our audience, I want to thank you so much for listening in to this podcast. If you like the content that I share with you on a weekly basis, or sometimes more than a weekly basis, please give us a like, share, or comment. Or if you have other ideas for other types of podcast subjects or topics that you'd like us to talk about, please email me and reach out to me directly, give me your ideas, and I'll be happy to talk about those subjects for you. Neil, thank you so much. I wish you a lots of success in the future. Hopefully you come back to the channel, and please consider the channel is yours. Anytime you have anything to share, please come back and tell us all about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.